understanding what this means was an exciting journey, and attaching my experience to it and understanding what it means to me changed my life. Right. So when this process was shown to me, it was life changing, and I got excited about it, and quickly started working with others, and in my first workshop I think I only had like 2 or 3 years at the time that I was asked to do this, and had about a dozen guys, and it was a very wide range of people there. And at one end was people that were very well read and very had really good reading comprehension. The other end of the scale was somebody that was practically illiterate. And it just so happened that he was the one with the most time to do what I gave him to do during the week, which is just go through the section that we're covering, and read the book and find the considerations in the book and mark them in his book. Right. So this particular guy was like so bad at it. We'd get together and we'd read the book and we'd discuss what we read, and he would read what he got out of it. And everybody would just kind of look at him and kind of squint like, huh? And what I realized is not everybody could read this thing and understand on their own what it's saying. So I had a computer early on, and it came to me that if I give this guy the notes out of my book and just had him do that, he'd be a lot better off. So I started staying up late at night until early in the morning, typing all my notes in from my big book into my computer so that I could hand it to this guy. And I never sat down to start to write this thing with an intention of it looking like this or ending up like this. I was just trying to help this guy in my workshop. And as I started handing him out, I realized that everybody benefited from it. The workshop moved faster. Everybody was on the same track. And what I also saw was my ideas and the things that I wrote down all of a sudden were open to scrutiny, right? Because this is what Dan thinks about what the book is saying. Now I had a dozen people telling me what they think what it really means, right? Or what it means to them. And what I saw was that there was a variation of what people saw in it, right? And separate from their experience, because certainly different people could have different experience, but the experience was based on what is the book really saying, right? Which is really what I was trying to get down to and understand. Because when you really understand what the book is really saying, then your experience around that is more focused, right? And as I got more in touch with what it was saying and what my experience was around that, right? Something started happening inside that I didn't even understand, right? You know, I was growing spiritually by this process that was evolving in front of me, and although going through with my sponsor was certainly life-changing, digging in and getting really analytical about this really made my program change, right? I was excited about it. I was, there was, and a lot of other people around me were getting excited about it. And, sometimes I'd call people up at, like when I saw that other phrase that I just mentioned, the one about the spheres really had their music. And I called one of the guys in the workshop at 3 a.m. to tell him what I had found in the dictionary. And he says, great, great, call me in the morning. And I was obsessed with it, and this is the result, and the result has been is not so much that it's new, because this is the big book's used by a lot of people. I was lucky enough to be in a place where there was a handful of people doing it, right? And there's a lot of people in Colorado around these people where my sponsor got it. So when you're lucky enough to be around people that are really good at presenting it, it's really easy to get it. But I found that there's, through this, that there's people all over the world that don't have that, that don't have people around them that can explain how to do this. So what's happening now is there's pockets of people all over that all they've got is the big book and this set of instructions that I send out, and they're getting together in little groups, and I tell them, you know, the bottom line is if you don't agree with something that's in here, the big book is right, right? Go by what you see in the big book. And but what's happening is there's pockets of people that are getting this thing, you know. And it kind of reminds me of how it was like in the beginning, because when the big book was originally written, it was because they wanted to get it to spread outside of the boundaries of their area that their few meetings were in. You know, and people were just sitting down, picking up a big book and reading it, and they were getting it and passing it on, you know, from across the other side of the country. But those were different times, right? There was a lot less radio. They didn't have television. I grew up watching television constantly. I think the Big Book was one of the only books by the time I got sober that I had ever finished, right? So what I found was that there's a lot of people that say that the Big Book is the only book they've ever read, right? So we grew up in different times than what the people initially that were reading this did. I believe that there was better readers back then, right? And today, I think more people are used to reading differently. And so having something that a guide to say, stop and look at this, ask yourself, what does this mean to you? Personally, my personal experience with this was it really improved my reading comprehension, because I take the same ideas and I read everything like this now. So that was kind of like a byproduct of the whole thing. But the main idea here is that I'm going to share with you some instructions to go through the big book that created movement in me, deep down inside of me, that changed my life. All right? So if you turn to... in the workbook, page 5. Naturally, I don't have time to go through the whole thing with you, but I'd like to touch on some main parts as we go through the day. And it refers to the title page, headed Alcoholics Anonymous. Everything from the title page to the doctor's opinion, but not including the doctor's opinion, I considered general information about Alcoholics Anonymous. For lack of a better term, I just call it the general information. And the first statement here is a big statement, and it gives me a promise, and it gives me hope. And it says the story of how many thousands of men and women have recovered from alcoholism. Right? Doesn't say that I'm always going to be recovering. Doesn't say that I'm always going to stay sick. It says how many thousands of men and women have recovered from alcoholism. And it's going to tell me what they mean by that. And we're going to touch on that in a few minutes. Right. In my book, I have a circle and triangle in it, and that's the emblem that you see in the middle of Unity Service and Recovery. It was in the book until 1994, when they took it out because of copyright infringements. See, if you know anything about copyright law, if you have a copyright and you don't protect it, you lose the right to it. And for years, Alcoholics Anonymous was asking people to not support the people that were selling the medallions and the T-shirts and all the AA stuff at the gift stores that you see. But people liked that stuff. And And but AA was faced with that issue legally. They had to tell people to not use it, otherwise they'd lose the copyright. So as they pushed for people to not use it, there was a lot of money being made by it, and those people refused, and it got to the point where AA had to either go to court or give up the circle and the triangle. And it's too bad for people that like looking at it in the beginning of this process, but I can understand that because it's against our traditions to hire lawyers and to go into court and fight for the circle and triangle, and to bring all the negative press towards Alcoholics Anonymous. So they figured it was easier to just let it go, right? And so they pulled it out. The circle and the triangle is an old symbol, and for many years prior to Alcoholics Anonymous, it's meant things like body, mind, and spirit, right? And but AA adapted the unity, recovery, and service to it, to the same symbol, the same shapes. And as far as what, you know, what is talked a lot about this is that, you know, as far as the left side here, the unity side, or the body side, you know, obviously my body suffered physical cravings from alcoholism, you know, and we'll get into all of this as we go through this. And initially, the only thing I could do is bring my body to a meeting, right? I didn't know what it all meant. I didn't know what it was going to involve. I didn't like the idea that I was, my life had got to the point where I actually thought I had to go to one of these meetings, you know. But there I was at a place, surrendered to the point where I was willing to see, you know, what this thing was about. You know, and from my first meeting, I stayed sober. Hadn't worked the steps, hadn't done anything yet. Just on February the 22nd of 1989, my life was a mess. I knew I couldn't stop drinking. And miraculously, February the 23rd of 1989 was the beginning of a process that brought my life to the place where I never drank again. Right, showed me a way of life conducive to not drinking. Right, but I wasn't quick to catch on to and jump into the whole process. I didn't rush out and get a sponsor. I didn't understand what that all meant. I was somewhat special, and I knew that I needed the perfect sponsor. You know, and I started examining what does that mean? What is it that I really need? You guys are telling me to find someone who has what I want, right? But my old vision of what I needed for my life to be okay was I thought that if I had the right learned the right things, got the right education, that I would get the right job, have enough money to buy the house and the car, and all of my stuff was going to set my life up to attract the perfect her, right? Those were the things I thought I needed for my life to come together. And you see it all the time with people that are new, right? Trying to get their family back and their work together, and you know, and it becomes more important than sobriety, right? It's because I believed that that's what I needed for my life to change, right? She was never good enough. The car was never right enough. The job was never what I wanted to do forever, right? I could never create that around me, right? So, but I still had this vision of that's what I needed in my life. So I started interviewing sponsors based on that. You know, what do you do for a living? Who do you hang around with? What kind of car are you driving? Right. You know, the guy that initially brought me into the program, he actually ended up to be my sponsor in the first year for the longest period until I actually switched to Joe. He hadn't had a girlfriend since high school. He was driving a Volkswagen, And, you know, he basically did just have a marginal program, though, and did eventually drink again. So, but anyway, I started to realize that there was something more here than what I thought I needed, right? Because Brian certainly enjoyed his life, right? And I started to see that was important, right? But as I said, I started burning through these sponsors in my first year, and I ended up walking. I got to 10 and 11 with Brian, and he didn't tell me this, but I don't think he actually did 10 and 11 himself or 9. He gave me the best instruction he could possibly give me. He said, "Go find yourself an 11-step meeting." I went to the directory and started thumbing through it, and I found a meeting called 9, 10, 11, and 12. Actually, it was called 10, 11, and 12 at the time. And I figured, okay, this is exactly what I needed. This is what he told me to find. And I went to this meeting, and that's where I met Joe, who became my sponsor for the next 10 years. And you got the bottom side of that triangle, my mind, right? I had sobriety now, but going into, just staying sober wasn't really enough, right? Things were still going on in my mind. I knew that there had to be something more for me, but I had done a little bit of step work up until that point with these guys that I had been working with previously, but it was nothing that moved me enough to really understand that and until I actually did the 12 steps outlined in the big book, you know, I didn't realize what I didn't have, right? So the bottom side of this circle and triangle, the recovery side, is the 12-step process. The 12 steps of this program, and they're outlined for me right here in this book. And then the third side, the spiritual side, or the service side, right? I look at that as carrying the message, right? It's not just necessarily about my spiritual program, but about what I've been brought to a place where I'm greatly affected by the fact that I now have something to share with others and to help others. And that's become sort of the basis of my life. And that's one place that I see some people think that the service side is setting up chairs at meetings or... And I don't look at it like that. I look at cleaning ashtrays and setting up chairs and making coffee as the unity side, as part of the fellowship. So I guess this brings me to a consideration that I like to talk about at this point, and that is, as far as AA's unity, recovery, and service, obviously that's what AA is, the meetings, the 12-step process, and working with others, service. So the question that I like to ask is, as far as the fellowship, the unity side, if you could pause for a moment and ask yourself, do you have a home group or meetings that you're committed to? Right? I mean committed to, the ones... You know, you work your life around showing up at those meetings, right? Because that's a commitment, right? A lot of people can say yes to that. They have their regular meetings. What I found is that people that have trouble staying have a very big lack of commitment to any particular meeting, not accountable to any particular meeting, right? And the second consideration is for the recovery side. It's, have I worked and finished the 12-step process outlined in the book? Right? You know, here you start to lose people, because a lot of people have hung around the program thinking that being in a 12-step program means just going to meetings, as I mentioned before. But the program tells me that there's 12 steps to work. And it's a fair question. Have I worked them? Have I finished them? A lot of people can't say that they have. And I'm talking about not just new people. I'm talking about people that have hung around a long time. And even people that have done everything their sponsors have told them to do. And then the service side. Again, I kind of group cleaning ashtrays and setting up the meeting and participating in the meetings as the fellowship or the unity side. The service side is carrying the message, working with others. It's no secret that they say that these Alcoholics Anonymous is about working with new people. Everybody knows that. But does everybody do it? And I don't mean picking up newcomers and bringing them to the meeting. Right? That's just carrying the alcoholic to the message. Right? I'm talking about, do I have a message to share with them? So based on those three ideas, what's AA? AA is, for me, is being committed to my home groups, finishing the 12-step process, and then being an example of those, that way of life, and sharing that with new people, working with others, taking them through the 12-step process, right, so that they can in turn do the same. So consider for yourself this, is that if I'm just going to meetings, then I'm just hanging around other people that are in Alcoholics Anonymous hoping to catch this thing like people catch the flu, right? Or if I haven't finished the steps and I've lost the urgency that I had in the beginning that I needed to do something here, right? Then do I really believe I'm an alcoholic by my actions, right? Obviously, if there's no urgency here to get more, I've made the conclusion that this is all there is for me here. And people suffer in Alcoholics Anonymous for years in that state, years. I've met people that were ready to that have drank in their 20 years of sobriety. I've met people that have that were ready to blow their brains out. Right? Just hanging around the meetings isn't necessarily getting everything that's here. It certainly helps, and there certainly is a power to the group, and it's certainly better than nothing, right? But I've limited the process here, that there's so much more for me to get, in the working with others, right? Anybody that works with others and takes them through the steps knows that that's the best part of this thing, and the majority of the people around Alcoholics Anonymous miss that. Right? And there's all kinds of excuses why I shouldn't do it. Work's real busy. My family. Right? But you're missing the best part. Right? And you're missing the part that makes you grow spiritually. Right? Because working with anybody that's worked with a lot of people know that the more they work with, the more they grow. Right? And, it's a great place to be in all three sides of this triangle. See, there's looking at this unity, recovery, and service, and also referring to it as the mind, body, and spirit. Mentally, I've been comfortable at times in the past, right? And as far as my body, physically I felt really good at times, and spiritually there was times that I felt like, I had it all, the new car, the new girlfriend, everything's wonderful, right? Deep, that feeling of well-being deep down inside, right? But I've never been, in the past, been able to hang on to that. Right? I've never been able to be at a place where I was living and operating from that place. And that place is, if you took a pen and put a dot right in the middle of that circle and triangle, right? That's a place that we'll talk about later, where the book refers to being rocketed into the fourth dimension of existence, right? It's just being rocketed into, right, inside, to the fourth dimension of existence, a place that's in balance between my body, mind, and spirit, living from and in a place that I've never been able to do before, right? And so there's a promise here, and that is, if action is taken in these three areas, I can be whole, right? Connected to the fellowship, work the 12 steps like my life depends on it, you know, and share that with others, work with others. You know, and then when I live that way, right, I'm living in a place of power, not powerlessness. Right? You know, because if I stay powerless, right, I'll die, right, and nothing will change. So, on the next page, on page 6. There's a plan of action here outlined in this book. And I think a lot of people are quick to go to the 12 and 12 because it's outlined so easily with chapter 1. You know, it's step 1, step 2, step 3. And it doesn't do that in the big book, but it certainly refers to a process that is outlined that is done in stages. When it gets to step 3, it tells you, and from step 3 on, it'll tell you exactly that you're, okay, now you're at step 3, now you're at step 4, so it's a little easier from that point on, but what throws a lot of people is, okay, where's step 1 and where's step 2? Well, this outlines your program of action. As I said, from the preface up to, but not including the doctor's opinion, is what I consider the general information, for lack of a better word. From the doctor's opinion on, we're going to see step 1. And the doctor's opinion, which is Roman numeral XXV, Roman numeral 25, up to page 38, and we include 44, 45, and 52 to examine this unmanageability. I'll look at step 2 in We Agnostics on page 44. By the time you get to step 3 and how it works, it'll tell you you're at step 3. And from then on, it'll tell you when you hit each step. Right? So this will lay out exactly what you have to do to find each step or where you're going to find each step. And we're going to look at step 3 in three parts. First, the physical part, what happens when I drink alcohol. Right? The mental part, what happens to me when I try not to drink alcohol. Right? And the third part, the unmanageability. Right? And it's going to be interesting here because at the end of this, I'm going to present a twist to this that's really important to know. Right? But they start off with the physical part because it's going to be the easiest to look at. Now, some of you may look at this and read this and ask yourself these questions based on alcohol and find that maybe it wasn't alcohol at all. Maybe for you it was drugs. Or maybe for other people it's something else. Right? So I'd encourage you as we go through this to consider, you know, what do these considerations mean to you personally? Because this is not about me telling you what you are. It's about you knowing deep down inside what the truth is for you, right? Because because a big part of my solution is knowing deep down inside an answer to that problem that's posed, that you've considered for practically your whole life, and that I've considered practically my whole life. So what's wrong with me? What's wrong with me? You know? All right, so I'd like to talk a little bit about some of this stuff in the general information. On page XI in the big book, I'm sorry, I'm in a third edition big book. It would be XIII if you've got a fourth edition big book. And I'm looking at the big book now, not the workbook. In the first, it's the preface. In the second indentation, where it starts off, because this book, it says, because this book has become the basic text for our society and has helped such large numbers of alcoholic men and women to recovery, there exists a sentiment against any radical changes being made in it. Here it calls this book a basic text. Again, if you're in a third edition, it's XI. If you're in a fourth edition big book, it's XIII. I see a couple people kind of searching for it. A basic text. What's a basic text? To me, a basic text is, say, if it's mathematics. A mathematics book probably in the beginning started you off with addition. And then after presenting that to you, they showed you subtraction. Then after they felt that you were okay with that, then they threw in some multiplication, and then they showed us division, and then started to get a little much more complicated beyond that, right? Algebra. Right? Well, that's a basic text. It'll start you off with the basic ideas and build on it. And that's what the big book does. Same thing. It'll start you off with some basic ideas that should be fairly easy for you to grasp, and then present things on top of that will take you deeper into understanding what does that really mean to you, right? So that's what they're talking about when they're talking about this basic text. And then on the next page, after that, there's a paragraph where it starts off, all changes made over the years. Halfway through that paragraph, it says this. It says, we hope that you may pause in reading. I'm sorry, I lost my page. I hope that you may pause in reading one of the 41 personal stories and think, yes, that happened to me, or more important, yes, I felt like that, or most important, yes, I believe this program can work for me too. Right? And that's going to be the basic idea of how we go through the book. We're going to go through the book, turn statements into questions, and pause while reading and ask myself, what does that mean to me? Right? It particularly points out doing this through one of the 41 personal stories, and Bill just happens to slip his story in the front of the book, so it's going to be the first one you hit. And you'll see that the first two questions here, did that happen to me, or more important, yes, I felt like that. That's the basic way you go through the first half of Bill's story. And through the second half of Bill's story, the great question is, do I believe that this can work for me too? Because he'll outlay this solution in the second half of his story. So the instructions for going through it and pausing while reading is in the book, right? But looking at it a little deeper, that's just basic good reading habits, right? When you're studying something, read it and think about what you read. So I'd like to move forward to the second edition, which should be on Roman numeral 27 for you, which was XVII, or if you're in a third edition book, it's XI. Certainly don't have time to go through this whole thing, but there's certain points that have to be stressed in the front to present the importance of step one to you, right? And at the bottom of this page where it starts off, the spark that was to flare, right? It says, the spark that was to flare in the first AA group was struck in Akron, Ohio in June 1935 during a talk between a New York stockbroker, Bill Wilson, and an Akron physician, Dr. Bob. Did anybody know what kind of a doctor Dr. Bob was? Yes. A proctologist. Now, can you imagine if a friend of you that knows you have this alcoholic problem tells you, hey, you know you have this problem. If you ever really want some help, there's this doctor down here in Akron that's doing a lot of good work with alcoholics. You know, and you decide that you're walking by this address and you decide you're going to just walk in and meet this doctor. And you walk up to the door and you see Dr. Robert Smith, proctologist. You'd really have to be really motivated to get sobriety if you saw a door that said that, right? You know, what kind of a solution could this doctor have for me? 6 months earlier, the broker had been relieved of his drink obsession by a sudden spiritual experience following a meeting with an alcoholic friend. That was Abby Thatcher that comes to Bill in Bill's story, who had been in contact with the Oxford Group of that day. So the Oxford Group was a spiritual program. It was like a fundamentalist Christian program that that believed that we all could move through the world being Christ-like, doing just helping others. And a lot of the early AAs had some exposure to the Oxford Group. And the Oxford Group got its name. This is kind of an interesting story. They were traveling, a bunch of them were traveling through India on a train. And, you know, when you see groups of people traveling, they'll have this all their luggage in one big pile, you know, in one place. And the people, the porters for the on the train had labeled this bundle of luggage the Oxford Group, because the group was actually traveling from Oxford, England. So all through India, what was following their luggage was this sign saying the Oxford Group, and the name just kind of stuck. When it came time to they wanted to name themselves, they said, "Oh, Oxford Group, we've already been named." He had also been greatly helped by the late Dr. William D. Silkworth, the New York specialist in alcoholism who is now accounted no less than a medical saint by AA members, and whose story of the early days of our society appears in the next pages. All right. So they're already making the point that he was greatly helped by this doctor. Right? And from this doctor, Dr. Silkworth, the broker learned about the grave nature of alcoholism. Though he could not accept all the tenets of the Oxford Group, he was convinced and now it's going to list five tenets of the Oxford Group. So if you're interested in seeing what these are in a list form, go to page 263. Page 263, and if you're in a third edition big book, it's 292. It lists the same things that are on this page, minus one, right? Because it says he could not accept all the tenets of the Oxford Group. He was convinced of the need for moral inventory, confession of personal defects, restitution to those harmed, helpfulness to others, and the necessity of belief in and a dependence upon God. He's just mentioned 2 through 6. The one that he couldn't grasp until he heard the doctor's ideas about alcoholism was complete deflation of ego. Right? See, Bill had exposure to the Oxford Group. He was around a spiritual solution. Right? But he couldn't grasp the idea of complete deflation of ego. Right. So prior to this journey to Akron, the broker had worked hard and with many alcoholics on the theory that only an alcoholic could help an alcoholic. But he had succeeded only in keeping sober himself. He was pulling people off of bar stools and out of alleys and bringing them to his house trying to get them sober. But he wasn't having much success, if any. I've heard of a conversation that he had with Lois, his wife, bringing this up and said, "Hey, you know, these people aren't staying sober." And Lois said, "Yeah, it's true, but look, Bill, you've stayed sober." So it started to be the beginnings of the understanding that there could be something happening here, right, where that shows that working with other alcoholics can do something in an alcoholic's life. Right? The broker had gone to Akron on a business venture which had collapsed, leaving him greatly in fear that he might start drinking again. He suddenly realized that in order to save himself, he must carry the message to another alcoholic. That alcoholic turned out to be the Akron physician. So now keep in mind here, there was no Alcoholics Anonymous meetings to go to. He had no sponsor. He had talked, you know, Ebby initially had come to him and brought him, you know, exposed him more to the Oxford group, but Ebby had started drinking. He only stayed sober for 2 months. He had no one to call. But because of his work with alcoholics, he realized what he needed to do was to find a drunk to talk to. So he went down to the phone booth of this hotel that he was staying at, and he put together this list of, he'd comprised this list of possibilities of people to call to find an alcoholic to talk to. And the last person on the list was Henrietta Sieberling. He didn't want to call her initially because it would kind of be like going to Palm Springs and just dropping Betty Ford a line. You know, it's like you wouldn't, because of who she is, maybe you wouldn't want to bother her because she had a name. But none of the other calls that he made led him to an alcoholic. And he called Henrietta. And he said, you know, this is why I'm calling. I'm an alcoholic, and I need to find an alcoholic to talk to. Otherwise, I'm going to drink. And she said, her response was, thank God, we've been waiting for you. Right? Because, see, Henrietta Sieberling was in the Oxford group, and they weren't ones to tell you that you're an alcoholic or that you're doing, they wouldn't push your problem on you. It wasn't just for alcoholics. It was for a lot of different reasons, but you had to come to this understanding on your own and want to be saved from it. So they would separate, other peoples from the Oxford group would have these prayer meetings without Dr. Bob, and they would pray for him. They would pray that God would send him something that will help him. And so when Bill called her, she was all excited, naturally, that their prayers had been answered. She had arranged a meeting with Dr. Bob and Bill. It says this physician had repeatedly tried spiritual means to resolve his alcoholic dilemma, but it failed. He went to church. He was involved in the Oxford group. He had the solution around him, right? But when the broker gave him Dr. Silkworth's description of alcoholism and its hopelessness, the physician began to pursue the spiritual remedy for the malady with a willingness that he had never before been able to muster. Until he really knew what was wrong with him, he couldn't accept the solution. Right? That's the deal here. Is until I really know what's wrong with me, then I really can't embrace the solution like my life depends on it. Right? I have to see step one in order to go to two, like my life depends on it, right? And Dr. Silkworth's ideas of what's wrong with me was pivotal here. And in 1955, when they moved, see, doctor's opinion started off on page one, so that was the first thing people read when they came into the program. Naturally, you skip through the Roman numeral stuff because the book really starts at step one, right? But they moved doctor's opinion into the Roman numerals because he wasn't an alcoholic. They decided that because he's not an alcoholic, they put him in the Roman numerals, which made people skip completely over the thing that was so important in the beginning. Here it says, after he understood the doctor's opinion, he began to pursue the spiritual remedy for his malady with a willingness he had never been able to muster. He sobered never to drink again up to the moment of his death in 1950. And it seemed to prove one alcoholic could affect another as no non-alcoholic could. The other people in the Oxford group couldn't bring him to that point. Right? It also indicated that strenuous work, one alcoholic with another, was vital, vital to permanent recovery. Right? And in a lot of areas of Alcoholics Anonymous, working with other alcoholics is not vital to their recovery. Working on their self is what they think, is what seems to be perceived as what's vital to fixing my life. Right? Yet, what I start to learn is I need more than what I can do on my own. Right? And I will get that when I have something to bring to somebody else. Right? So, it goes on to talk about them going to AA number 3, who was Bill D., a lawyer. That's the next paragraph. And basically, when they presented him the doctor's opinion of what's wrong with him, then he was able to go along with their solution. So based on that, it's time for a break now. And hopefully that stressed the importance of step one and your recovery process. And when we come back, I'd like to start talking about some of that, the doctor's opinion. Thank you. We'll see you in how long is it? How long is the break? 15 minutes? Okay.